Ladies and gentlemen, in my first lecture, I discussed the metaphysical base of objectivism, the recognition of the fact that reality is a firm, objective absolute, that everything which exists possesses identity, that consciousness is the faculty of perceiving and identifying that which exists. Last week, I discussed epistemology. Epistemology is the science that studies the nature of human knowledge. I presented the basic pattern of the structure of man's consciousness. Reason is man's faculty of perceiving reality, the process by which man's consciousness proceeds from sensations to perceptions to the formation of abstractions or conceptions, the nature of the subconscious, the nature of emotions, and the fact that emotions come from man's conscious or subconscious premises. This evening I will continue the discussion of epistemology. I will take up the question of what is thinking, what are the standards of correct reasoning, that is, reasoning which gives us actual knowledge of reality. I will discuss that crucial, most unappreciated science, logic. You have all heard the popular misconceptions of the role and function of logic. Most people believe that logic is some dry, formalistic science, a kind of aimless parlor game for unemployed intellectuals who waste their time quibbling over words. Most people believe that logic at best is unrelated to human existence, and at worst is an actual threat to man's enjoyment of life, to his emotions, to his values. You have all heard such popular catchphrases as the cold hand of logic, men cannot live by logic, etc. Well, let us consider a few examples of how men do live, and if there is such a thing as a cold hand that sweeps over their lives at times, leaving desolation in its wake, what is its nature and its cause? These examples are instances of the kind of suffering which, in one form or another, all men encounter in the course of their lives. Suppose you work in an office, you are doing an excellent job, and your boss praises you highly. But when the time comes for a promotion, he gives it to another man who is blatantly incompetent and undeserving. You are left with a bitter feeling of disappointment. If you try to find an explanation for the injustice, you will probably conclude that your boss was hypocritical, or that he was cruel, or if your thinking is not too precise, you might go so far as to blame the capitalist system, deciding that all employers are hypocritical and cruel. What you probably will not realize is that hypocrisy and cruelty are not primaries, and they explain nothing. But they come from a deeper cause, and that the real essence of the boss's injustice toward you, the real root of his evil, was the fact that he acted illogically. Suppose you are in love with a girl and engaged to marry her. Suddenly, without warning or explanation, she refuses to see you or to answer the telephone when you call. A few months later, you learn that she had eloped with a man she had met the day before and had married on the whim of the moment. You might explain her behavior by concluding that she was dishonest or promiscuous, or that all love and sex are evil. But the real cause and essence of her evil was that she had acted illogically. Suppose you are a research scientist, and after years of desperately hard work, you succeeded in solving the problem that had been your goal. It is a great achievement and a great moment for you. You rush to the man who is your best friend to share the news with him. He listens indifferently, says, "How nice," and proceeds to tell you the latest football scores he heard on television. You might explain it to yourself by concluding that he is insensitive or hypocritical, or that true friendship is impossible among men. But the real cause and essence of his evil is that he had not given you any thought. He had acted illogically. If you look back and analyze any instances of disappointment, disillusionment, or suffering you have endured in your relationships with people, any harm or injury they have done to you, you will find that under all the other more superficial causes, the basic cause was their irrationality, their refusal to think, their lack of logic. Any feeling of bitterness, suspicion, futility that you may now have in regard to men, the feeling that it is hopeless to expect any fairness, kindness, or understanding from them, comes from the countless instances stored in your subconscious of the bewildering inconsistencies, contradictions, evasions, injustices you have encountered in dealing with people. Instances of human irrationality, of the illogical demands made of you, of the illogical responses to you. And I venture to add regretfully, in such cases where you have caused pain or injury to others, you have done it by being irrational, by acting thoughtlessly, illogically. You have all heard the phrase so frequently used as a lament by altruists and humanitarians, man's inhumanity to man. I wish to state that the essence of this inhumanity, the factor responsible for it, is irrationality, and that no other single factor, not even deliberate sadism, has caused the suffering and destruction comparable to that caused by the irrationality of well-meaning, good-intentioned people in the history of mankind and in the personal histories of individual lives. The suffering that erodes and destroys a man's spirit, undercuts his self-esteem, shrivels his ambition, wipes out his incentives, kills his enjoyment of life. The suffering that drains the enthusiasm of youth and brings an eager, curious, benevolent child to that state of gray, cynical lethargy, which in our present culture is regarded as adulthood. What is sadism when compared to that slow, daily, all-pervading process of murder in which well-meaning people are constantly engaged? Besides, sadism, too, is only the manifestation, the result, of irrationality. The irrational is the unthinking. It is the willful defiance of reason. To act illogically is to exhibit contradictions in one's behavior. Now, in this context, let me read to you again the quotation read in the first chapter, a quotation from Will Durant's popular Story of Philosophy, quote, "But no man ever lived who could lift logic to a lofty strain. A guide to correct reasoning is as elevating as a manual of etiquette. We may use it, but it hardly spurs us to nobility. Not even the bravest philosopher would sing to a book of logic underneath the bough." Close quote. Ladies and gentlemen, Atlas Shrugged is a hymn to logic, to the power and importance of logic. You will have observed that the three parts of Atlas Shrugged are named after the three Aristotelian laws of logic: non-contradiction, either-or, A is A. The generally accepted dictionary definition of logic is the art of correct reasoning. This is true, but it is a description rather than a definition. It defines the field with which logic deals, the field of reasoning, but it leaves open the question of what is correct in reasoning. Ayn Rand has answered that question with a specific definition. Logic is the art of non-contradictory identification. The full importance of this definition will become clear to you as we discuss the nature of logic. In the process of acquiring knowledge, of moving from the perception of concretes and particulars to the formation of wider and wider abstractions and concepts, and in the applying of concepts to new particulars, new concretes, man's mind does not function infallibly. Error is possible to man. Therefore, man needs a standard by which he can judge the truth or falsehood of his conclusions, the validity or invalidity of his thinking. He does not possess such a standard automatically or innately. His mind must discover it. That standard is logic. Aristotle was the father of the science of logic, the first man who formulated the principles of correct thinking, the principles that all men must obey if the attainment of truth is their purpose. The three Aristotelian laws of logic are the law of identity, the law of contradiction, the law of excluded middle. The last two are merely corollaries or restatements of the first. The law of identity states that everything which is what it is, that a thing is itself, that a thing's identity is that which it is. In algebraic formulation, the law of identity is stated as A is A. The law of identity was discussed in the first lecture as the basic principle of metaphysics. It is crucially important now to realize that the law of identity is also the basic principle of epistemology. It is the link between the two sciences, the bridge between existence and consciousness, between reality and knowledge. As a principle of metaphysics, the law of identity tells us that everything which is what it is. As a principle of epistemology, it tells us that contradictions cannot exist, that a thing cannot be A and not A, and therefore, if we reach a contradiction in our thinking and draw two contradictory conclusions about the same thing in the same context, we have made an error. Our thinking is wrong. Our thinking does not correspond to reality, and we must check our conclusions, our reasons for them, our premises. The law of contradiction and the law of excluded middle are specifically epistemological restatements of the law of identity. They are epistemological rules to guide man's thinking. The law of contradiction states that nothing can be A and non-A at the same time and in the same respect. Thus, if the law of identity states that a table is a table, then the law of contradiction states that nothing can be a table and not a table at the same time and in the same respect. A tablecloth cannot be green and non-green at the same time and in the same respect. Contradictions cannot exist. At the same time and in the same respect, no attribute can be present and absent, no effort can succeed and fail to succeed, no action can be good and not good, no entity can be man and not man, no man can be alive and dead. It is the law of contradiction which teaches us that if all men are mortal and Socrates is a man, it is rational to infer that Socrates is mortal and irrational to conclude that he is not. That if a theory conflicts with the facts of reality, the theory must be rejected. That a theory to be valid must integrate all and clash with none of the relevant evidence. that if a scientist's investigations lead him to the formulation of two mutually exclusive hypotheses, at least one of these hypotheses is wrong, that no proposition can be both true and false, that if a mother simultaneously demands of her children that they think independently and that they obey her on blind faith, she is not a practitioner of rationality. And neither is an employer who gives switching and irreconcilable orders, and neither is a moralist who preaches that self-abnegation leads to self-fulfillment, and neither is a political theorist who declares that men can achieve freedom only by establishing a slave society. Logic is the art of non-contradictory identification. The law of excluded middle states that everything is either A or non-A at a given time and in a given respect. For instance, either this is a table or it is not a table. Either this tablecloth is green or it is not green. Observe, and this is very important, that I have not said either this is a table or it is a chair. I have said either this is a table or it is not a table. I have said either this tablecloth is green or it is not green. In accordance with the law of excluded middle, I could also have said either this tablecloth is red or it is not red. This would be true in regard to this particular tablecloth. It is not red. But I could not say, as a universal principle, either this tablecloth is green or it is red. This would be an obvious absurdity. A tablecloth may be green or red or blue or yellow or plaid or polka dotted, etc. But whatever color a particular tablecloth happens to be, the universal alternative is only that color or not that color, green or not green, red or not red, polka dotted or not polka dotted, etc. This particular identity or not this particular identity, without specifying any other kind of particular identity. The law of excluded middle states everything is either A or non-A. It does not state everything is either A or B. At a given time and in a given respect, either an attribute is present or it is absent. Either an effort has succeeded or it has failed to succeed. Either an action is good or it is not good. Either an entity is man or it is not man. Either a man is alive or he is dead. Either a proposition corresponds to the facts of reality or it does not. But no third alternative is possible. There is no middle of the road between truth and non-truth. There is no compromise between existence and non-existence. The question is sometimes asked, why are the laws of identity, contradiction, and excluded middle regarded as the laws of logic rather than other such logical principles as, if A implies B and B implies C, then A implies C. Or if A is greater than B and B is greater than C, then A is greater than C. The answer is that these latter formulations are narrower and less fundamental. They are specialized applications of the law of identity. They are not as wide or as comprehensive. The law of identity and its two basic corollaries, the laws of contradiction and of excluded middle, are the fundamental laws of logic because they are the most universal and all-inclusive. They have application to everything that exists and to all propositions. There are certain common misconceptions and misrepresentations of these three laws of logic by means of which the laws are frequently attacked. You will often, for instance, hear the following argument against the law of excluded middle. It's not true that everything is either A or non-A because it's not true that everybody is either rich or poor. Some people have middle incomes. Now, the law of excluded middle does not hold that everybody is rich or poor. It holds that everybody is either rich or not rich. Well, consider this argument against the law of contradiction. This law states that nothing can be A and non-A at the same time and in the same respect. Suppose you say that a white rose is white, which, to be precise, means that the color of its petals is white, and someone then proceeds to claim the law of contradiction will be invalidated a week later when that rose will fade and become brown. He is obviously ignoring the specific content of that law. The law of contradiction does not claim that a white rose cannot become brown in changed conditions. It merely claims that a rose cannot be white and brown at the same time. Now suppose that person asks, but what about that rose in the process of fading? Wouldn't it be both white and brown at the same time? And of course the answer is, not in the same respect. Part of its petals would be white, other parts would be brown, perhaps some parts would be whitish brown, but no petal or part thereof would be white and brown at the same time. Besides, the exact identification of that particular rose at that particular time would be a white rose in the process of fading. A very common attack on the law of identity goes as follows. It's not true that A is A. It's not true that a boy is a boy because he's a boy today, but in a few years he'll be a man. Now, the fact that in a few years a boy will be a man does not change the fact that at any and every moment of his life he is something specific. That a boy is a boy, that an adolescent is an adolescent, that a youth is a youth, that an adult is an adult. The fact that an entity contains the potentiality for change inherent in its nature does not contradict the fact that that entity is what it is, that it is itself, and the changes possible to it will be determined by its nature, by that which it is. Thus, a boy will grow into a youth, then into an adult, then into an old man. He will not grow into an ostrich, then into an old man, then into a chair, then into a pig. You will sometimes hear nonsense to the effect that the laws of logic are static and constricting, that they do not acknowledge or allow the dynamic possibility of change, motion, time, etc. Well, it is precisely the laws of logic that make it possible for man to deal with change, motion, and time. They expand man's view past the range of the immediate moment and make it possible for him to predict the future changes of the presently existing entity, as well as the conditions of such changes. They make it possible for a civilized mother not to fear that her baby will change into a bat or a wolf, as medieval mothers used to fear. They also make it possible for a man who is about to kill a cockroach not to worry whether that cockroach is his grandfather, as many inhabitants of India do believe to this day. The only kind of dynamism which the laws of logic do not allow is the possibility of having one's cake and eating it too. As you observe, the laws of logic demand of you an absolute precision in your use of words and concepts. When I say absolute, I do not mean omniscient. If you use the word man, for instance, you do not have to know everything that could possibly be known about man, but you do have to know what you know, and you do have to know the exact meaning and context in which you use the concept man, in order to avoid such traps as the one involved in the example of a boy growing into a man. If you wish to be logical, if you wish your thinking to be efficient, if you wish to avoid contradictions, then, to put it in simple colloquial terms, you must always know what you are talking about. It is the laws of logic that guide us in the process of thinking, of drawing conclusions from our observation of the world. Obviously, in order for our reasoning to yield us an actual knowledge of reality, it is necessary not only that our thinking be free of any internal contradictions, but that the premises with which we start be true. The base of our knowledge is, of course, our direct and immediate perceptions. Perceptions are the given, the self-evident. The meaning of self-evident is available to direct, immediate awareness. The law of identity is the abstract statement of a self-evident fact, the fact that things are what they are. The difference between the self-evidence of sensory perceptions and the self-evidence of the conceptual metaphysical axiom of identity is only this. The axiom is implicit in every perception. Man is aware of it directly with every perception, but he requires an accumulation of perceptions, an accumulation of knowledge, before he can formulate the axiom. A baby, as we have said, is implicitly aware of the law of identity with his first sensory awareness of reality. But he cannot identify it consciously, and he cannot formulate it into a conceptual statement until much later. It is only when man grasps the law of identity that he gains control over his conceptual knowledge. By means of this axiom, he can retrace his knowledge, he can check the validity of any concepts, abstractions, and inferences he has drawn so far, check them by retracing them back to their base in perceptual reality, in his direct, immediate perceptions. He can bring his knowledge, his mental files, into non-contradictory order, and then he can go forward in pursuit of new knowledge as a fully conscious adult and thinker, now armed with a standard by which he can test the validity of all his conclusions and inferences. Thus, the axiom of identity may be described as a delayed immediate perception. Immediate in the sense that it is perceived directly. Delayed in the sense that it has to wait for a conceptual formulation before it can enter man's conscious awareness and change from the implicit to the explicit. The same principle, of course, applies to the other logical axioms, that is, to metaphysical axioms, axioms implicit in the concept of existence or being as such. To quote from Galt's radio speech, quote, "An axiom is a statement that identifies the base of knowledge and of any further statement pertaining to that knowledge. A statement necessarily contained in all others, whether any particular speaker chooses to identify it or not. An axiom is a proposition that defeats its opponents by the fact that they have to accept it and use it in the process of any attempt to deny it." Close quote. This last sentence is an answer to the neo-mystics who claim that there are no self-evident axioms, that philosophical axioms are a matter of faith or arbitrary choice, that anyone can choose anything he pleases as a philosophical axiom, and that any choice is as valid as any other. Which would mean, of course, that man's knowledge rests on thin air, on subjective whim, that faith is as valid as reason and science, that there is no such thing as knowledge. The test to determine what is an objective philosophical axiom is not the number of people who may or may not accept it, of the fact that no statement, proposition, concept, abstraction, claim, knowledge, or pretense of knowledge is possible or definable without it, and that all attempts to deny it contain it implicitly. For instance, if a man chooses to claim as an axiom that the universe was created by green gremlins, one can refute him without using the concept of green gremlins and without having to accept their existence implicitly in one's argument. And if a man claims that he does not choose to accept the law of identity, he has already accepted it implicitly in the fact that he has uttered a specific sentence of a specific meaning, that he intends his sentence to be what it is and to mean what it means, and not the opposite. An axiom does not require proof. It is that on which all proof rests. The laws of logic are axiomatic. They are merely the restatements of the law of identity. They are not inferred or deduced. They are the means which make inference and deduction possible. They require no proof. They are the means of proving. To demand, as the neo-mystics demand, that the axioms of logic be proved is to evade the meaning of the concept of proof. Proof is a process of inference. It consists of establishing that a proposition is true by deriving it from previous knowledge. This implies the existence of previous knowledge, which is axiomatic and self-evident, as distinguished from inferred knowledge, which requires proof. If no self-evident knowledge existed, if all knowledge required proof, if all propositions had to be derived from earlier propositions, there would be an infinite regress in the chain of reasoning. Knowledge would have no starting point. It would have to start out of nothing, out of zero, out of non-knowledge. This means that there could be no such thing as knowledge and no such concept as proof. One proves a proposition by demonstrating that it is logically necessitated, that its denial would contradict facts already known to exist. If no facts are or can be known directly and self-evidently, there can be no proof and no such concept as logical necessity. Since logic is the standard of proof, since it sets the principles of proof, by what means and by what standard is logic to be proved? Until one has grasped that A is A and that contradictions cannot exist, there can be neither proof nor even the concept of proof. Those who demand proof for axioms and for the laws of logic are guilty of the fallacy of ignoring the genetic roots of concepts, the fallacy of the stolen concept, which we discussed last week. It is only the concept of logical axioms that makes the concept of proof possible. The law of identity is a genetic root of the concept of proof. Those who claim that they do not accept the law of identity can no longer claim any meaning for the concept of proof and cannot ask that anything be proved. Strictly speaking, the neo-mystics of today do not literally demand that the axioms of logic be proved, or rather, the demand is implicit rather than explicit. It is contained in their assertion that since the laws of logic cannot be proved, they cannot be known to be true, they cannot be known to apply to reality. Today it is fashionable among modern philosophers to assert that the axioms of logic are arbitrary. But this is to confess that one has forgotten how such a concept as the arbitrary was originated. An arbitrary idea is one accepted by chance, caprice, or whim. It stands in contradiction to an idea accepted for logical reasons, from which it is intended to be distinguished. The existence of such a concept as an arbitrary idea is made possible only by the existence of logically necessary ideas. The former is not a primary. It is genetically dependent upon the latter. To maintain that logic is arbitrary is to empty the concept arbitrary of meaning. To declare that the axioms of logic are hypotheses or merely probable is to be guilty of the same contradiction. The concept of the hypothetical or of the probable acquires meaning only in contradistinction to the known, the certain, the logically established. It is not a primary. Only when one has grasped something which is certain can one arrive at the idea of that which is not, and only logic can separate the latter from the former. Many neo-mystics contend that the axioms of logic are accepted, not because they are known to be true, but because they work, because they are practical. To contend this is to evade the question of how one decides what is or is not practical before one has grasped that that which is, before one has acknowledged that A is A. Many neo-mystics assert that the axioms of logic do not pertain to existence and do not reflect the nature of reality, that they pertain only to language, that they merely express the manner in which men have agreed to use words and connect propositions, and that men could have chosen otherwise. To assert this is to make the use of language a matter of arbitrary whim, to make thought a matter of arbitrary whim, and to place oneself in the category of a schizophrenic. It is the schizophrenic who does not believe that his statements or method of inference need bear any necessary correspondence to the facts of objective reality. Those who contest the self-evident certainty of the law of identity are unable to escape its implicit acceptance and use. They seek to prove their claims by means of the very logic they deny. They use concepts such as infer, demonstrate, arbitrary, hypothetical, probable, which only the axiom of identity makes possible. They attempt to adduce evidence for their position, assuming that their evidence is something, that it is what it is. They argue, implying that if their theory is true, it is not simultaneously false. They cannot escape that which they seek to reject, because existence is identity. Just as man cannot, without contradiction, contest that A is A, so he cannot contest that he is able to know it. Just as it is an axiom that existence exists, so it is an axiom that consciousness is conscious. In principle, it is a single error to demand that the axioms of logic be proven, and thus to imply that there can be proof prior to logic, or to demand that existence and consciousness be proven, and thus to imply that there can be proof prior to existence and consciousness. The error consists of ignoring the hierarchical structure of knowledge, of ignoring the genetic roots of concepts, of treating complex ideas as primaries, and using them to attack the more fundamental concepts from which they were derived, and without which they would not be possible. Philosophers have recognized the fallacy of question begging, the fallacy of assuming as true that which one wishes to prove and using it as part of the proof. But it is equally a fallacy to assume and to use that which one wishes to disprove. Existence, consciousness, and identity are the presuppositions of any demand for knowledge and any claim to knowledge. They are the irreducible base of all human thinking. Logic, like all of philosophy, is a science that applies to all specialized sciences and makes all specialized sciences possible. Logic does not teach us the content of any specific knowledge, it teaches us the process of acquiring any and all knowledge. Logic is the tool of reason. Logic is based on facts, on the fact that that which is, but it is not a science of facts, it is a science of method. It is imperative always to remember what we have established about the hierarchical nature of man's knowledge. Man's concepts, inferences, and conclusions rest on earlier concepts, inferences, and conclusions, which ultimately rest on direct, immediate percepts and on the law of identity. Man's knowledge is a long, integrated chain, no part of which is valid out of context without the genetically antecedent parts. It is like a skyscraper in which no story can stand without the lower stories, and these cannot stand without the foundation. There can be no such thing as out-of-context knowledge. All knowledge is acquired on the base of previous knowledge and can be no better than that base. All knowledge is contextual, which means has to be integrated, has to form a logical, consistent, non-contradictory whole. All thinking, states Galt, is a process of identification and integration. All logic is a process, then, of context-keeping. No conclusion of a formally logical argument can be considered true out of context. Only a full context can determine its truth or falsehood. And in a full context, the logically true is the factually or existentially true. It is utterly indefensible to speak of logical truth as opposed to or apart from factual truth or existential truth. If a statement is true at all, it can be true only of reality. There is nothing else for a statement to be true of, nothing else to which the concept of truth can meaningly or validly be said to pertain. People often reveal an excessively narrow view of what it means to be logical when they maintain that a bank robber is logical because he devises an ingenious, complicated scheme for robbing a bank. It is true that the bank robber does employ logic in his calculations, but this does not mean that his action, in the total context of his knowledge, was a logical one to undertake. Enormous irrationalities, evasions, and breaches of logic were necessary to bring him to the decision of becoming a bank robber. Everyone uses logic at some time or another in his life, on some subject or another. But these occasions often may be logical only in a formalistic, out-of-context sense of the word. An illustration of this would be a neurotic parasite who lives by mooching off his friends and saves his logic for playing chess. If you understand that the principles of logic are based on the metaphysical nature of reality, you will understand the grotesque irrationality of any doctrine of polylogism. Polylogism means many logics. Polylogism claims that there is no one universal logic, but there are many different logics. The salient exponents of this idea are the Russian communists, who claim they had a special proletarian logic as opposed to our bourgeois logic, and the German Nazis, who claimed that they had a special Aryan logic as opposed to the non-Aryan logic of the rest of the world. The motive of such claims is, of course, obvious. They make it possible for any criticism to be refuted by the simple expedient of declaring that it is based on bourgeois or non-Aryan logic and is thus invalid. This is blatant subjectivism, subjectivism applied to epistemology in the same manner as they apply it to metaphysics. This is mysticism, as any subjectivist doctrine necessarily is. Just as there can be no such thing as two or more different realities,